Welcome to the Expert Bureau. I'm Clodagh Higginson, partner at Higginson Strategy, and what we found as the coronavirus pandemic began to take hold globally is that contrary to previous claims, the world is not sick of experts. In fact, we desperately need them. We launched the Expert Bureau, therefore, as a platform to allow journalists fast access to the relevant voices needed to communicate with the public. Today, our expert webinar asks, what is the future of journalism post-COVID? The pandemic has already radically altered the news industry, with newspaper sales and advertising revenues plummeting, even as people become increasingly dependent on fast and high-quality news throughout lockdown. It's clear then that journalism has a crucial role to play, but like all other industries, it must adapt to the new normal. Before we start discussing how this might be done, let me first introduce our speakers. Anne Alexander is Senior Political Producer for Good Morning Britain. She's covered Westminster politics for 18 years. Anne has a background in regional newspapers and has worked for both the BBC and ITV. Claire Ellicott is Political Correspondent for the Daily Mail, who previously worked at The Independent. She's a published author whose articles have also been featured in Business Report and This Is Money, among many others. Roy Greenslade is Emeritus Professor of Journalism at City University London and has worked for the full gamut of British national newspapers from the Daily Mirror to the Sunday Times. He has been a respected media commentator for almost 30 years, writing a long-running column for The Guardian. Mary Fitzgerald is Editor-in-Chief of Open Democracy, the independent news website. Her writing has been published globally in outlets including The New York Times, New Statesman and Al Jazeera, among many others. Frances Ingham is Director General of the Public Relations and Communications Association, the world's largest body for public relations professionals. He is also External Examiner to the American University at Richmond and Master of the City of London Company of Public Relations Practitioners. Thank you all so much for taking the time to join us today. But for now, let's open up today's discussion, which I will put to all of the panelists, starting with Roy. So what is the future of journalism?
Well, to be honest, I'm really gloomy. But then I've been gloomy for many years. Before COVID, we could see that newspaper circulations were falling away. We could see the growth of an online audience, and that's great. But what we couldn't see was how we were going to fund journalism. And what COVID has done, and I hate to use that cliche about perfect storm, is it has brought about, I think, the moment of the cliff fall, as I call it, because I don't think we're going to restore newspaper readerships. People will continue to access online in their many millions, but the range of journalists, the scale, the number of journalists is declining almost on a daily basis. And it doesn't matter whether it's a serious newspaper with a small independent owner or a large corporation, the story is exactly the same. And what I fear is that, and I'm sure we'll pick this up as we go on, what I really fear is that a lack of journalism is, I think, a threat to our kind of democracy. I saw a report recently, I'll finish on this point just to open with, I saw a report recently, only a couple of weeks ago, which had discovered that as you lose local papers, so you see a decline in the number of people who vote. That for me, and I've been saying that for years, based on my instinct, now we have a report which shows it. And I think what that seems to suggest is that if we don't have newspapers, if we don't have a vibrant press, if we don't have a way of informing people about what's going on in terms of who rules them, then we face the possibility of a big democratic deficit.
Thank you, Roy. Anne, you've worked amongst those who rule us, as Roy puts it, for almost 20 years. What do you say about the future of journalism?
Well, one of the big issues for me is trust. Because obviously we're in the middle of a pandemic, and I think maybe trust has been shaken a little bit in the government because of the response to the pandemic. So I think at a time when trust in journalism has been undermined by some political leaders, not just here, but also across the pond, there's never been a more important time to actually have a really strong strong estate to actually hold those in power to account. So it worries me that journalism is being criticised and being held up for criticism when actually it's possibly unfair, and at a time when the public really need to have trust in the people who are telling them what's going on. So that worries me a little bit. also, you know, we see so much going on online, and we have sort of stories that spread, and this issue about fake news and suspicion around vaccines and so on. So for me, the big concern for me, as well as journalism contracting, is the issue of trust and how important it is that we do have a body of journalists that we can actually trust, which we know we're trustworthy, but it's actually making sure that the public know that we do our utmost to actually make sure what we're bringing them is actually true, and that we've done our due diligence to make sure that we're actually giving them the facts, the unspun facts.
Thank you, Anne. Claire, you're actually Anne's colleague, as it were, in the, you know, privileged press lobby at Parliament. What do you say about the future of journalism working for the Daily Mail as you are at the moment and looking forward?
Well, everything Roy said about kind of the future looking a bit gloomy is right. But I think in a time like this, we have to think about how best to keep the industry going and in what way we can survive. And I think newspapers especially are facing a great threat from the big tech giants and their kind of stranglehold on advertising revenue, which obviously we rely on. And I think the only way forward for newspapers, obviously circulations are only going one way, and younger generations just don't read newspapers and certainly don't buy them. The only real way that the industry is going to be able to survive is if it makes money. And I think the only way it can make money at the moment is if media brands create a kind of trusted product that has to become a subscription-only product that people will pay for. And it will have to be more reliant on generating funds that way than relying on advertising revenue anymore and otherwise. So I think the future of journalism can be great, but it doesn't look great at the moment. And we'll all have to diversify if we're going to survive in this post-pandemic world.
Thank you, Claire. Now, Mary, your organisation is entirely online. What's your position about the future of journalism?
Well, I wanted to echo some of the points that Claire made. And I think what I was preparing to say before was that journalism, as we know it, does not have a future unless we have other business models. Claire made the point that advertising model is dying and online that's not going to change. I mean, COVID obviously has accelerated that demise, but relying on advertising is not going to sustain the type of public interest journalism that Anne and Roy spoke about that we really desperately need and is a prerequisite for having a functioning democracy. But I think where I would probably differ is that I don't think that subscription models are the only way to go. There are plenty of other models that need investment and thought and consideration. I mean, again, to pick up the point about the tech giants, we need to tax them. And that tax needs to fund public interest journalism, and it needs to be organized in a way which is completely politically independent and at arm's length from the state. And I work for an organization that has, thousands of readers give us voluntary donations. Also, we don't have a paywall, but we make the case powerfully, as does The Guardian, that our journalism should be supported. And thousands of people choose to do that, even though it's free at the point of access. There are other models as well. I think that we're a global organization and governments and philanthropic organizations across the world are waking up to the fact that you don't have democracy without a functioning, vibrant fourth estate that privileges and values and promotes public interest journalism. So I think that at the kind of multilateral level, we're talking about the EU or the UN or certain enlightened governments, there are funding models there and philanthropic organizations. But again, you've got to be very careful because that the way that that money is distributed has to have absolutely no political or vested interest attached to it. So you need some very clever mechanisms around funding journalism as a public good. But I really do think journalism is a public good in the way that transport is, roads, schools, hospitals. And we've really got to start thinking about that and thinking about what public funding outside of, you know, the BBC model and others looks like to create a plural, diverse, vibrant media that produces public interest journalism.
Thank you, Mary. And I'd just like to remind the audience to get busy on the Q&A function here so we can come to your questions afterwards. Just before I go to Frances, our final panellist, with the opening question, what is the future of journalism, Frances?
Thanks, Clodagh. So I agree with Mary that there is a really pressing need for a vibrant fourth estate. And that is pressing from the PR industry, which I represent as well. The reality, as Roy and Claire have said, is that journalism is going to be a smaller industry going forward, sadly, is probably the inevitable truth of where we are. And that is a problem for my industry, because we want a vibrant, large journalistic community that we can communicate with. The issue of trust that Anne referenced is one of the key things we want as well. My members want their stories placed in newspapers to be credible, to be believed, to be in voices that are heard, listened to, and taken notice of. So we have this joint interest in a vibrant journalistic community. And on the making money element that Claire mentioned, you know, we see the shift of spend from advertising towards PR and from advertising in old traditional media towards new platforms. And we just all need to live with that as well, I think. I mean, my final comment would be that our industry is going through a massive contraction at the moment. I think by the end of the year, we'll be down by about 20% globally. But then we expect recovery. And my members talk about, over this period, the importance of reputation having been absolutely embedded in every organisation, whatever your public, private, whatever. And that is a great opportunity for the newspaper industry and the journalism industry, because my members represent people who want their corporate reputation to be improved, defended and enhanced. And they can only do that by a good, proper relationship with journalism.
We've got an anonymous attendee here asking, how can the media industry get the tech tax over the line? Claire, you know, you work there at the heart of Parliament, but also you're affected by, you know, these sorts of things in your job. So what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, the government have been promising us an online harms bill for years now. And there have been all of these suggestions that they will somehow kind of break up the social media giants so that they're not the huge, powerful behemoths that they are. But we're not really seeing much action from the government. I think they're reluctant to do it. I think they prefer some form of self-regulation. But the facts of the matter are that if the tech giants continue to be treated as, well, to be classified as platforms rather than publishers, this goes back to what Mary was saying, then they just don't have the same responsibilities that journalists and the newspapers have and websites have. So you have journalists kind of taking all the risk, publishing difficult stories, and you have the kind of digital giants just creaming off all the advertising revenue. And that's a model that really doesn't work for the publishing industry and is strangling local newspapers especially. The solution to it is going to be difficult. I think it probably lies within reclassifying these big companies as publishers or as something slightly different to publishers, so that they have to pay a fair price for content, or that they have the same responsibilities in what they do with the content. But in terms of the government doing anything, it doesn't, I mean, I don't have much hope that we're going to see anything anytime soon.
Would anyone else like to come in there? Why will the government not do anything anytime soon? Boy? Anyone?
Well, I think that they find the task of dealing with Silicon Valley too immense to face. And there's a big problem here about restrictions of freedom of speech, and takes us to the nature of regulation. I mean, at the moment, they do have to obey the law in terms of, say, incitement to violence or racism, although I think that they don't take enough action, or at least the authorities don't take enough action in serious cases. But I think the problem of restraining him in that sense is not the way ahead. I agree absolutely with Claire and Mary about the platform publisher argument. They are publishers, and they are clearly publishers and need to be treated as publishers. Convincing them of that is proving to be very difficult. And this is a long argument. I mean, I don't think that you can step in with legislation quickly without thinking through the immense difficulties. But I want to go back, if I could, to the matter of funding. Because I think what we face is the need for a mixed economy. We're going to have philanthropy. We're going to have a modicum of advertising, although I think that's completely over, really. We're going to have subscriptions, which have been tried and in some cases have worked. We're going to have a need, rightly, to tax Silicon Valley, the tech giants and so on. And perhaps, and this is much more controversial, a level of public subsidies. If the government and ministers and MPs, they're constantly paying lip service to the fact that the local press is a wonderful organization and we need to sustain it, but they're doing nothing about it. How can they sustain it? I think we have to think about and I know this is an unpopular view, to think about a BBC style tax on people to sustain public service informational journalism across certainly local and regional newspapers in order to ensure that we don't suffer the kind of thing I outlined at the beginning, which is a gradual demise of our democracy. So I think funding, I think a trust is right. I absolutely agree about trust. I think one of the reasons that you could say that will sustain journalism is the idea of your organization winning the trust of people. Then if you win the trust of people, they're going to be happy to pay for it. They're going to say, look, I trust this organization. I don't want it to go to the wall. I will pay for it. In many ways, that is the way ahead. Now, I know that social media critics of mainstream media, as they dub us, view us as having sold the past. We weren't good enough. We were too partisan. We told too many lies. We got up to all sorts of tricks. We have to row back from that. If we're to have a future for journalism, we have to be better behaved. We have been better behaved since Leveson, in my view, much better behaved, but there is still room for improvement. But trust, putting that at the heart of selling your journalism, is for me the way ahead.
Thank you, Roy. And do you think that Good Morning Britain viewers would be willing to pay a BBC style fee for other content?
I mean, I'm not sure that the public are very keen to pay for anything. Basically, we're in a position now where, obviously, if you go back, say, 20, 25 years, you go and buy your newspaper, maybe daily, maybe weekly. People were used to paying for their news. Along comes the internet. Suddenly, we have all this information and it is free. Well, people think it's free, but it's not, because we all know, as the saying goes, you know, good journalism costs money. But people now, because they got used to getting news for free, on the internet, not really good quality news, people don't want to pay. So you had all these newspapers who suddenly put all their content online, then realised the business model wasn't working. And then they bought in paywalls like the Times, the Telegraph, you know, the Guardian now has a lovely little suggestion that pops up whenever you go onto their website asking you to support them. So I think it is difficult to row back and go back because we were spoiled. If you go back 15 years, we were spoiled when the internet exploded because we could get our news for free. And now we have this huge campaign against the BBC. You know, I suspect in the next 10 years, we probably won't have a licence fee. I think there'll be a different business model for the BBC. So I can't see Good Morning Britain viewers or other viewers actually paying for content in that obvious way because we've been spoiled, because we've got used to this system. I mean, I don't know what the answer is because we've let it go too far down the road and to actually try and row it back because we wouldn't have thought twice about paying for, you know, for newspapers back years ago. But also, I just wonder whether there might be some sort of model to maybe look at, say, how Netflix works or how, you know, Sky works or what have you, where you pay a subscription for a certain body of work. But and I don't know whether there might be an idea of maybe getting a group of different broadcasters together, whether it be like ITV, some BBC, some Sky, all together, and you subscribe for, you know, to maybe four or five channels where you can get all your news. That might be a route to think about, but I do think it's going to be difficult to persuade the public to do that, because we've gone so far down the road.
Thank you, Anne. We've got a question just come in from Chris Mitchell. He doesn't say which organisation he's from, but Chris is asking, how do the panellists think trust in the news and journalists can be rebuilt when the media landscape seems to be so polarised, with audiences dismissing outlets because they believe they are biased and have a partisan agenda? Why should someone on the right wing believe media they see as left wing and vice versa? And what needs to happen to help audiences accept and engage with outlets that contradict their views without being dismissed as fake news? Claire, if I could come to you on that. The Daily Mail often takes a fairly polarised position itself, but would seek to obviously inform all of its readers. And I'm sure with feedback that you get from Mail Online, your massive news website, that trying to engage with people is something that the site tries to do, as well as the newspaper giving its own version. How do you feel as a journalist there that you are responding to those accusations that you're on one side or another?
Well, I think this is all overplayed. I think if someone sat down with all of the national newspapers every morning and read them all, there's so many similarities. We report stories as they happen, and what changes is you're writing for a specific audience, a specific readership. You know what their interests are and what their views are of the world, and you echo that in the stories you choose to cover that day. So I think it's less, I think the picture is less biased than people think it is. And often I think if people kind of gave newspapers a good read, they might see that. And if we're like approaching a story, actually it'll be the same across every newspaper. What changes is what stories you choose for your reader. But I think there is a big problem with trust, and trust in the media over the last decade or so has really been eroded. There have been problems that, you know, the Leveson inquiry, people don't trust journalists. We're always on the scale of, usually below politicians, thank God, but we're always on the scale of you know, public figures that people don't trust. And that's a real problem, because I feel like most individual journalists actually feel like they've got a kind of mission to get the truth out and to find out what's really going on. And I don't know how you kind of bridge that gap, but I think the industry has to do more to make sure that we're seen as unbiased, and that we are just seen as serving our readers, but not in a way that would ever kind of obfuscate the truth.
Thanks, Claire. Yes. So Dominic Ponsford, who is the editor of the Press Gazette, of course, says there is a BBC style tax to fund journalism, Mr. Roy Greenslade. It's called a licence fee. Isn't it time this was shared more fairly among those doing public service journalism to solve the democratic deficit and provide more accountability for those in power at a local level? The BBC currently shares a pittance of its funding with local news providers via the Local Democracy Reporters Scheme. Shall I come to you first on that, Roy, and then others feel free to pile in?
Well, of course, I agree with Dominic, and indeed, that's exactly what I meant, that we need to add to the licence fee, as it were, and that's why I think it would be unpopular. As for the Local Democracy Reporters Scheme, which has produced some wonderful journalism and wonderful journalists, it still is the case that we're kind of funding companies to do that, rather than being absolutely secure in the knowledge that the money is being used properly. In other words, I think there's a lack of accountability, which I wrote about in company with Stephen Barnett in the British Journalism Review, which got the employers really terribly worked up. And they complained a great deal, because they think the Local Democracy Reporter Scheme is a way of the BBC paying for reporters while they lay other reporters off. That's the problem. So I think it needs, if we're going to do this, if we're going to have a public subsidy for journalism, we have to ensure it's not putting the money in the hands of proprietors who've let us down in the past and who exist only to make money. They don't exist for public service reasons. They are living off public service, as it were. And what Claire says about individual journalists seeking the truth, I know that's the case. And there's some fantastic examples of very good journalism. But the truth is, and this goes right back to the dawn of capitalism in newspapers, is that newspapers are hierarchies run by owners and their appointed editors. And they decide what goes into a newspaper, what the size of the headline will be, how big the display will be, what the angle should be, what to leave in and what to leave out. And therefore, that's the problem with getting at the truth. So journalists are really servants of owners and proprietors. And there's the real problem we face.
But the BBC, obviously, best known for its being licence funded, is not without its very many critics. Is the answer really to have yet to demand yet more money from taxpayers? Anyone else on the panel want to come in here?
I mean, I think the truth is that we have to have competing BBCs, if you like. We have to have, I agree, somebody mentioned the need for a plural and diverse a universe of the media, which we previously had, but not plural and not diverse enough, in my view. So if we're going to have public service journalism, there's nothing wrong with having competing public interest journalism. The point is putting public interest at the heart of all journalism. That's what really counts.
Anybody else like to come in on this?
Mary needs
Mary, to. Please.
Yeah, I was just going to add to, I guess, amplify the point about trust and funding. So I agree with what Claire says about journalists and how they're, what they're motivated by, and that they're lodestars. And I think one of the things we haven't done enough of an industry as an industry together in recent years, we're storytellers as well, right? And we haven't told the story of our work and why we do it, and what it involves, and some of them, you know, some of the risks that are taken, and you know, there are some amazing podcasts out there, you know, that sort of like chart over, you know, 12 episodes, you know, these fascinating investigations and stories. And actually, I think that we could all be telling the story of the work we do, why we do it, and what its results are, and why it's important. You know, for our democracies, you know, and for citizens, in ways which are far more effective than we do currently. And that's not to be kind of insular or to you know, to slap ourselves on the back too much, but to really make the case for why, you know, why we exist and the work we do, and tell compelling stories about it. And the other thing about trust, and that this kind of relates to it, is I think that we could, as an industry, build more trust if we showed more professional solidarity with each other. So someone in the question box asked, what can the government do to protect press freedom? The truth is the government is doing, I mean, it's actively working against press freedom at the moment, right? The style of this new government and the way that Downing Street has run right now has attracted international condemnation. Reporters Without Borders have condemned the way they've operated as Trumpian attacks on press freedom, right? These are NGOs that monitor these things globally. We have a lobby correspondent, James Cusick, who's had a lobby pass for 25 years. He was told that he was not permitted to ask questions at those daily COVID briefings. And he'd been done reporting on, you know, from inside hospitals. And, you know, he had done a lot of really serious, important COVID reporting at the start of this crisis. You know, when I don't
know. What reason was he given, Mary?
The Open Democracy was a campaigning outlet. So they it was that you do campaigning, you don't do journalism, right? And so the government was making a definitional claim on what journalism is. And we're not alone. The Guardian and the Mirror, again, tried for 6 weeks to get answers about Dominic Cummings's ill-fated trip where he tested his eyesight by driving for half an hour. And, you know, for 6 weeks, they said, no, you know, we're not going to answer you because you are campaigning outlets. And I think we should just shift this. Imagine if we had a left of centre government, right? Left-wing government, and outlets that are right of centre, the Telegraph, the Mail, were trying, you know, the same thing happened to them, which you could easily see happening the other way around, let's say a Jeremy Corbyn government or whatever, right? It's not about where your politics is at, right? It's about the fact that we need, if any of us get shut out, and if any of us get derided, or the legitimacy of our claim to be doing journalism is undermined, we should all speak as an industry about that, and as colleagues about that, because, you know, they come for you today, they will come for someone else tomorrow. And it's really concerning. I'm doing a lot of reporting on the United States at the moment. I'm going to be there next week. And it's just, you know, the slide based on government action and sort of political positioning can be very, very fast. And again, it's been sort of independently flagged, and there are sort of international observers that are concerned about the direction of travel, that this country is going down really fast. So I think we need to tell much more powerful stories about why we do the work, how we do the work, and the benefits and consequences of that work. And we need to stand up for each other, even as we compete over stories and readers. We need to stand up for each other as an industry and as a profession.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for bringing in that extra question, which they're coming in nicely, thick and fast now. And just over the halfway mark, Clara Long asks, quite rightly, she says, sounds like we're focusing on the change in the media landscape more generally. And she wants to ask specifically due to COVID, as we started out. You know, before COVID hit, she says, success stories were being told both about the Guardian and paywall style models. Long term, how do the panel think COVID will affect this permanently? If we look beyond the current crisis, which, like most crises, however severe, won't be permanent. Frances, what do you think?
In terms of paywalls
yes.
that people consume journalism. I mean, my industry would like a vibrant, big journalistic media to interact with. And in a way, it was an easier world when we just had big newspapers and big newspaper groups that were pumping out stories. The reality is, I think we've lost that world forever. And, you know, the explosion of social media means simply that everyone who wants to be a journalist is a journalist. And there isn't really any rowing back from that. I mean, the people I speak with, members I speak with, they are far less focused on the big newspaper publications than they used to be. They found more efficient ways of getting their message across. And I think it was you, Anne, who said that the mistake publishers made was all going down the all free route, giving everything away, and then realizing there wasn't any money in it, essentially, and then trying to claw their way back. And I genuinely wish publishers good luck in clawing their way back. But I think it is a very difficult thing. They've sort of let the dog out of the garden gate and the dog has run away. You can try and call it back and good luck to you. That being the case, therefore, I just think publishers have to find better ways of selling their content. The advertising model of adverts in papers has gone. I mean, I was reflecting last night before this. I last bought a newspaper last year. I look at content, and I used to buy newspapers every day. I used to buy newspapers for the whole office. And then I realized that it was only me who was reading the newspapers, and all my junior team, they consume all their stuff in a social setting. So we just all of us, your industry, my industry, just got to reflect where reality is, accept it and move on with it, really.
Claire, you've had your hand up there. Come in.
I completely agree with what Frances has been saying. I think the industry's been really hit. The digital advertising problem is massive for us. But this is kind of going back to what I was saying at the beginning about subscription models. And I kind of want to offer the Mail Online as an example of this idea of kind of like cat going out the bag and everyone having given away their content for free. So the Mail Online is obviously one of the world's best read, I think it's the world's best read news website. It's huge. But I think it only broke even a couple of years ago. It doesn't make the kind of money that the paper makes with the paper's kind of specific advertising model and knowing its readers very well. And the only thing that, you know, obviously newspaper circulation is going down, but only by a bit. They'll be around for a while, I think. But this whole idea of a subscription model, the New York Times is kind of the model for this. They've got like 6.5 million subscribers, I was reading this morning, paying subscribers. The Times has done something similar here. And the Mail's kind of got a kind of app, the Mail Plus, which is it's trying to develop at the moment. But I think this idea that people won't pay for content anymore is slightly changing. I think, things like Netflix and Spotify, even Amazon Prime, people will pay for premium products if they think they're getting something more. And I think maybe the future for the newspaper industry and the digital world is creating a kind of quality product by a trusted brand people are willing to invest in.
Thank you, Claire. Anne, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I was just going to add briefly, I agree with Claire. I think there needs to be value added. I think at the beginning, when newspapers started doing their paywalls, it was literally just so that you could watch it, you could actually read what they got online. It was just the same as the newspaper. But there has been a move in recent years to actually add extra stuff, which Claire was just referring to. The Daily Mail app is a really good example of that. So I think that probably is the way forward, but you're going to have to offer people a lot more than what we're being offered maybe 5 years ago in terms of, you know, actually paying for this content. Because what's the point when you can actually look on Twitter, and a lot of people, as we know, don't read whole stories. They read like the first two or three paragraphs. And if you've got a company tweeting out their main lines, you can see what the main line is. You can read that. What's the point? So there has to be more on offer. And I think the newspapers and the news organisations are actually now catching on to that, which is positive. And hopefully that will be good for everybody in the future.
Thanks, Anne. I was just going to come to you, Roy. You wanted to come in there, but I wanted to add an additional question and ask it to you first. Anne Packard asks, is crowdfunding of stories a way forward? And in a way, with that nice, neat message that you get at the end of all of the Guardian links when you read them online, that's sort of prompting crowdfunding, isn't it? It's inviting and asking for it. So is that sort of, are we going to see that all over online content now?
I doubt it. I think you have to be very specific. It is crowdfunding, by the way. Voluntary donations are crowdfunding, let's face it. And I think it works. As I said earlier, if you build up enough trust with a large enough audience, then you will people will donate. And The Guardian have done very well with donations, but it's a minuscule amount of money compared to what The Guardian needs to fund its journalism. So I'm not absolutely certain about that. Let me go back to my gloom, if I might. Let me take you back to my youth, which was an awful long time ago, in the 1950s. The only paper in our house was the Daily Mirror. Not that my parents were rabid left-wingers, that was just the paper of choice. And it was the paper of choice later of 5 million buyers a day, probably with an audience of 15 million. Similarly, large circulation of the Daily Express, massive circulation of the Daily Mail. What did this do? I think, aside from the politics of those newspapers, as you open the paper each day, you were discovering things about the world, whether it was close to home or far away, that you would not have sought if you contrast it with now being online. In other words, what we've lost with newspapers, in my view, and what is difficult to regain, and I'd love to hear people come back to me with suggestions, what we've lost is the range of knowledge, the range of information available in the old style printed newspaper. People go online, they make sure that they are going to places which, as it were, amplify their prejudices. In terms of politics, but in terms of the narrowness of the news agenda, they're not able to see, as you do when you turn the pages of a newspaper, other things that they would not necessarily have known. They remain unknowns, unknown unknowns, as it were. So what we're doing, and this is really my point, in the days of the mass media, you had a mass audience which was in many ways being educated through what they were reading in newspapers. Mm-hmm. What we're doing now is we are splitting, and I understand Mary's view about the idea of trying to sell ourselves better, but we'd still only be selling ourselves to a relatively small, knowledgeable, affluent, educated audience. And what we're doing is gradually removing the possibility of educating the masses. We are forming a society of the knowledged and the unknowledged, of the knowledgeable and the unknowledgeable. And if you see this the way this has worked out in Trump's America, I see the same thing happening dangerously in Britain as well. As we've already touched on, or I touched on, we're lacking that democratic process in local elections. We've seen gradually the numbers taking part in all elections going down over the years. And therefore, and these become, in other words, this splits our society, splits it in two, and into which the mass, and maybe even I could make a point here, political point about Brexit, in which we see the arguments of many people who voted for Brexit being false arguments, based, of course, a lot on what they were told by politicians and by right-wing newspapers. And these people standing there outside Parliament going dancing crazily are not being informed in a rounded fashion as they were in the days of mass newspapers. That's my real concern, that online narrows the range of information that you're going to pick up.
Mary, I see your hand is up there, and I was indeed about to come to you and ask you, well, first of all, come in there on Roy's points.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I completely agree with everything he says. And the experience of reading a newspaper is so different from reading news online and scrolling news online. You do access more things that you weren't necessarily going to look at. I absolutely agree. And I think that's why, although I am very pro paying for journalism and getting consumers of journalism to pay for journalism, I worry a bit about subscription models in this new era that we're in, because it further intensifies kind of echo chambers and the kind of divides that Roy was talking about, which is why I've emphasized more public funding, voluntary donations, you know, philanthropic government, you know, the idea that public interest journalism is an infrastructure project that you need to maintain and invest in, like roads, like schools, like hospitals, because I feel, although we should pay for journalism, it's valuable and it's important, you're putting up walls that are going to be very hard to break through, and people are increasingly going to strengthen their own filter bubbles and echo chambers because they're making choices about the kinds of content they consume, which is already happening online anyway. It's just a sort of that is an acceleration of that dynamic that Roy's talking about.
But should the government step in, Mary, to protect journalism and journalists?
Well, I mean, this was the point I was addressing earlier, which is like, I wouldn't trust them to do so. But yeah. But I think when I'm talking about public funding, what I really mean, when we've touched on this, some of the license fee and the idea of having a sort of package of products that are funded through public funding in one way or another. But I think what we're, you know, and there are initiatives going on across Europe about this. That what I mean by public funding is actually something far bigger and more ambitious and kind of multilateral, that is organized very, and that is distributed at very, very arm's length, anything to do with government, even much more so than the BBC model currently is. So that's what I mean about public funding. I don't necessarily mean government making decisions about what gets funded or policy decisions about anything to do with journalism.
Mark Galloway from the International Broadcasting Trust, and if I could put this first to Anne, there's been a lot of talk about the threat to local journalism, but I'm worried, he says, about the quality of international coverage as budgets get cut, and as Brexit means we are likely to become more insular as a nation. What do you think?
I think that's a possibility. I mean, obviously, as a broadcaster, we have to cover news that we think that our viewers are going to be most interested in. And obviously, there are things going on internationally, which we will cover. But, you know, it's to a certain point. I mean, we are all about getting the maximum amount of people watching our programme. So as much as there might be something severe going on, you know, halfway around the world, if we don't think our viewers are going to be that interested, it's probably not going to make, because in the end, we're looking at our viewing figures, and viewing figures will impact our advertising revenue. We're a commercial broadcaster. So, I mean, I don't know whether that's all linked into Brexit necessarily. I mean, you know, we kind of see Brexit as this sort of a big sort of a bogeyman. But I mean, you know, and there's a suggestion that, you know, we're going to become more insular, but I don't think it's linked to that. I mean, for us, it's literally, will our viewers be interested? Will they switch off if we go off to somewhere that maybe our viewers have not particularly heard of? Mm. And then, so you mentioned at the beginning of the question about local journalism being impacted. I just wanted to make a really, really quick point just about local newspapers. I started off in local newspapers, and I used to work in the regional lobby. I was a reporter for the Express and Star and the Yorkshire Evening Post, working at Westminster. And when I started in 2002, there was a huge regional lobby, and now it's contracted massively. And so there's less representation in Westminster from regional newspapers. I just wanted just to make that point, because that's something which I think has damaged democracy overall, because you don't have as many people representing regional newspapers actually based in Westminster. But for the overall point, in terms of international coverage, I think for us, definitely at ITV, at Good Morning Britain, you know, it is about who's going to be watching and whether people are going to carry on watching us. So potentially, yes.
Thank you, Anne. Claire, would you like to come in there?
Yes, I think, I mean, in terms of budgets being cut, I think, you know, this is something that's going to impact the whole industry. We've already, loads of people have had pay cuts. There's been loads of redundancies that there will continue to be. There's some kind of small signs that things are returning for nationals, at least, that advertising is picking up again. I think that advertising returned a bit in September and probably will die off again. But in terms of it affecting our coverage, I don't think it feeds through that way. We would, again, as Anne said, we would always just the Mail and I think other national newspapers would always just reflect what their readers think. You do have fewer correspondents overseas now. I remember when I first started, I was working at The Independent, and it had loads of foreign correspondents all over the world, and I think it has hardly any now. And even big papers like The Times that had so many foreign correspondents, they've got fewer, and the whole industry is just like, it's just difficult to fund things. And I think it all comes back to that problem of money. How do you make the money you need to fund the journalism and keep people around the world and in the UK doing what they should be doing? And the problem Anne mentioned with the regional lobby, we all worked on local newspapers. I worked at the Liverpool Echo when it was, you know, the most fantastic, vibrant regional newspaper, just great fun, like real campaigning newspaper. Every door you knocked on, everybody knew who the Liverpool Echo were. Everybody wanted to speak to you. And I just think that's died so much. I mean, my local paper in London has moved to Hertfordshire. It's just, the picture looks so bad for local newspapers. And that affects the whole of the industry, because they're the people who feed through to the nationals and who end up becoming the kind of journalists on national newspapers. And you just don't have that local connection anymore.
Thank you. I mean, we've definitely been subscribing to Professor Greenslade's school of doom a little bit here, and understandably so. But we've got a very interesting question that's come in from the Israeli correspondent, or rather, sorry, Nick, I'm going to try to pronounce your surname, Koliohin, the Xinhua news agency correspondent in Israel. And he says that so far we've had a very interesting discussion, so thank you to you all. He says, what do you think of the possibility of commercial cooperation between news outlets from different countries that on the one hand don't compete for the same news consumers, while on the other hand could help each other financially and in other spheres of production? He says he is now trying to develop this kind of cooperation between Xinhua and other local news outlets in Israel. Is that the future here? Mary.
Yes, I was going to bring this point up actually in reference to what was said before, which is, and Claire's right about budgets getting cut and therefore very many, many fewer foreign correspondents across the piece. But, you know, that's a pretty expensive way to produce foreign news, and you can produce quality foreign news with meaningful, deep quality partnerships with outlets and with local journalists in other countries. And again, like we're talking about the decline and the challenges facing local journalism, the same is true in many other parts of the world. And so those kinds of relationships, building those kinds of relationships are absolutely key to the future of keeping foreign reporting alive. And it's a model we've used a lot. We've got a lot of partners and colleagues and local reporters on the ground who bring us some of our best international stories. And we rarely, you know, pay people to go elsewhere and do the reporting, but we rely a lot on those relationships, and there's a lot to be gained from there, and it's far more cost effective. So I'd say that, yeah, those kinds of partnerships are key, and what the questioner was pointed to as well was the kind of commercial relationships where you're sharing production capacity, tech, you know, resources, other assets. I think obviously any government that's run, any outlet that's run by a government, there are going to be concerns and sensitivities around doing those kinds of partnerships. But in principle, the idea of media outlets collaborating across borders, sharing resources, you know, commissioning and working with local journalists is absolutely an important model, and one that we've already seen some value and benefit from.
Thank you, Mary. Adam Watts tells us firstly that he runs an independent network of 600 conservatives in communications. A recent survey of theirs showed that almost 2/3 of respondents believe that the mainstream media is failing to provide balanced and unbiased reporting. We touched on this earlier, but is that a fair criticism? Anyone want to come in?
I'll have a go if you like. I mean, I you know, balance is always in the eye of the beholder, to be honest. One man's conservative outlook is another man's socialist outlook. It's really difficult to get to grips with this. You know, it's the whole argument about what is impartiality and so on. But on both sides of the right-left split, There'll be people at sea in output that it's biased one way or the other. I'd have travelled for ages on the train from Brighton to London with a man who is, a good friend of mine, but he absolutely believed the BBC was anti-Brexit. And as we know, lots of other people think it was very pro-Brexit. It is very difficult to be absolutely certain in this case. Can I lift my gloom a little for one moment?
Yes, please, Roy.
And stick to COVID. what I do think is that there are examples across Britain during COVID, and this goes for the national and the local press, of really good coverage of the whole coronavirus drama. And sometimes, and I guess your correspondent just now would say that this can be biased. Today's Manchester Evening News, for instance, which is, by the way, they've got an investigative journalist there called Jennifer Williams, who does absolutely brilliant work and has been doing it for years. But the paper itself today has got a splash, a lead front page showing Boris Johnson dressed as the Joker, which would be unusually biased I think many conservatives would feel. But it is just one of the examples in which there has been a flowering, if you like, in this drama, in this time of great drama and falling circulations. It's clear that some editors, some journalists are doing their level best to both entertain and at the same time inform the public. So I never want this to feel that I'm being negative about journalists. I am negative about all sorts of things, about ownership and about editorship, but definitely not about journalists themselves and journalism.
Thank you very much, Roy. Anne wanted to come in there just before we wind up.
Yeah, I was just going to say really briefly, I always enjoy looking at Twitter and so on, and the BBC in particular being criticised from both sides. So if the right's criticising you, if the left's criticising you, you must be doing something right, is all I can. I mean, also, we all know, I've talked about, bias and impartiality in journalism. We all know that it's subjective. The way we see news is totally subjective. It's based on your own prejudices, where you come from, how you've grown up and so on. So that you're never going to be completely impartial as a journalist. You can't be, because we're all individuals. But we just try to be fair in the way that we actually put our stories out there. So I do think, we have all these, lots of people like to scream from one side or the next about impartiality, but the bottom line is, and we all know this, that the majority of journalists are trying their best just to actually give you the balanced truth. But there are certain things where, there oughtn't to be there ought to be bias, whether it's murder or what have you. But I do think for the most part, we do try our best to make sure that we're just presenting the facts in a fair and balanced way, or as fair and balanced as we possibly can, at least anyway, as human beings.
Thank you, Anne. We've got about a minute left, and Chris Mitchell sort of poses the question, or rather sort of the observation, that there's the old adage that news covers events and not situations. Given many of the big stories are incredibly broad and complex, do you think that journalism of the future can handle covering things like the climate crisis, COVID-19, or situations in Syria, for example? I might just need a thumbs up or a thumbs down from you all for this last minute, really. But are we all just doing our best? Is it fit for purpose? Claire?
Oh, I think actually there've been a load of opinion polls that show that people have trusted the media during the COVID crisis. And I think the Queen said something positive about journalism during the coronavirus crisis. And it's clear that there are a lot of problems with the government's approach, and that journalists actually have got to the bottom of a lot of this. All of these contracts that have been handed out, we don't know where they've gone to. They've not been accounted for. The people who are finding that out are journalists and lawyers who are delving through all that. We need these people to work out what's really going on behind the scenes. And I think newspapers, big broadcasters, we are equipped to do that. And we just need the support of the public to be able to.
Thank you all very much. We've run out of time. That was extremely interesting. And I'd just like to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That's all from us here at Expert Bureau. And our next examination will be on that of experts in the field of education. Stand by.